feeling is weird. Some days you're okay and you're doing just fine. Other days it still hurts like it's fresh. It's a process with no definitive time frame. You just have to keep going and know that when all is said and done, you're going to be okay.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Navigating Life with Neurodivergence. This past week, I've had a few people reaching out to me to talk about their own experiences after listening to some of my previous episodes. And I just want to say personally, thank you. My entire goal here is to create a community where people feel safe to discuss some of the more taboo aspects of processing the world differently to the people around them. With that in mind, today we're getting brutally honest about something that is often misunderstood, and that is self-harm and suicide. On the surface, they might look alike, but beneath the scars, the burns, bruises, lies a profound and critical distinction. Talking about self-harm or suicide is never easy. It makes people uncomfortable and it brings out fear, concern, and that often leads to misunderstanding. One of the hardest things to explain, especially after you've recovered, is the difference between self-harm to regain control and suicide as the bottom of the pit, where it feels like the only way forward is to stop existing altogether. From personal experience, they have come from two completely different places in my mind, but I understand from the outside they often look the same. But trying to explain that to people who haven't been there is often near impossible. My own personal experience, self-harm has never been about wanting to die. It wasn't about punishment and it wasn't a cry for help. It was about control. When my thoughts were too loud, when my emotions were overwhelming, or when my mind felt like it was spinning out of control, self-harm brought everything back into focus. It was something tangible when everything else has felt chaotic. Pain is predictable, whereas, by my own admission, my emotions are volatile. When my thoughts are racing and erratic, pain is something that I can understand. It gave me something to focus on instead of drowning in the spiraling of my thoughts. I could anchor myself in the present moment. It turned mental anguish into physical pain. Emotional suffering is abstract, it's invisible and unquantifiable, but physical pain, that was something I could measure. People assume that self-harm is always about wanting to die. But for me, it was often the exact opposite. It was about wanting to stay here, trying to keep my head above water long enough to make it through, about being present. When things got worse, whenever I stopped believing there was a way forward, that would be when my thoughts shifted from holding on to letting go. Self-harm might seem confusing, even incomprehensible to many. Why would anybody deliberately hurt themselves without wanting to die? Prominent voices from Child Mind Institute and Autistica highlight that self-harm, clinically known as non-suicidal self-injury, is often a coping mechanism to manage intense emotions or sensations. It is a desperate attempt to regain control or alleviate overwhelming distress. For me, self-harm was never about seeking death. It was about survival. Cutting my legs or burning my back with blisteringly hot showers wasn't impulsive madness. It was methodical. Each injury offered temporary relief, a grounding force amidst chaos, aligning with what Merck manuals describe as brief emotional calm following the act. Conversely, suicide, as in true suicidal intent, is fundamentally different. Research from Frontiers highlights that suicidal acts are driven by a deep hopelessness desire to escape unbearable pain permanently. Now, I have genuinely tried to end my own life twice. Both times, I genuinely believed I was doing the right thing for my family and for the people I love the most. First time involved a large medical overdose after my partner at the time had pretty much instructed me to do it. A decision that I almost immediately regretted, and a situation that was made worse by her cruelty in deleting the messages from my phone and telling me that I wasn't even capable of getting suicide right. The second more recent time was an attempt to bleed out in my own bath, which was intended after a final holiday with my family. Both attempts were heavily influenced by manipulation and the toxic spiral of psychological and emotional abuse, which distorted my reality so severely that suicide felt like the rational, merciful choice as a way to free myself and to tragically unburden those around me. Suicidal thoughts aren't just an extension of self-harm. They come from an entirely different mindset, one that is much, much darker. And when I reached that point, it was no longer about control. It was no longer about grounding myself. It was about believing completely and entirely that this was the best thing for everybody. People often tell you suicide is selfie, but it doesn't feel selfie. In fact, it felt like an act of kindness. The world would be better. The people around me would be better. The burden I believed I had become would be gone. It didn't feel dramatic. It felt calm, almost peaceful, like I'd finally figured out the solution to a problem I had been wrestling with for so long. I didn't want to die to escape pain. I wanted to die to help. And that's the part people don't understand. It wasn't a reckless, impulsive decision. It was one that made sense in the moment, but in a terrifyingly logical way. But when you're in that place, when you're in that mindset and you truly believe you're doing the right thing, trying to explain that to someone who hasn't been there is impossible. And that's where it gets difficult, because people have questions after you've recovered. Once you've survived, once you've pulled yourself out of that pit, or in my case, once other people have helped pull you out of that pit, people expect you to see it the way they do. They expect you to say, I can't believe I ever thought like that. They expect you to admit it was a mistake, a moment of weakness, and they expect you to regret it. But the truth is, it made sense at the time. And even though now I'm glad I survived, even though now I know my mind was lying to me, I also know that past me truly believed they were doing the right thing. It's hard to talk about because people hear suicidal thoughts and immediately assume recklessness or selfishness or a desire to hurt others. But what they never consider is the part where I genuinely feel like I was helping. And how do you explain that? How do you tell people that at one point you genuinely believed they would be better off without you? The guilt of that realization has its own kind of weight. And the guilt is what I regret. I don't look back at these attempts with regret of the act. The only thing I feel guilty for or regret is seeing how it impacted those around me and the emotional stress and strain that it caused to those people at the time. But the reality I witnessed afterwards, both personally and professionally, have revealed something entirely different. In my line of work, I have been unfortunate enough to be the bearer of bad news when a loved one has been successful with their own attempt. And from that professional perspective, informed my personal understanding of suicide. No suicide leaves behind emptiness. Despite certain individuals cruelly expressing their disdain at my survival and suggesting I should have tried harder, it was ultimately my family and friends who suffered the deepest wounds. Every suicide leaves devastation in its wake. I've seen it firsthand. Even individuals who believe themselves to be entirely alone have left behind loved ones who were utterly heartbroken. The National Autistic Society further underscores that autistic individuals experiencing suicidal ideation often struggle deeply with communication and emotional processing, complicating interventions and amplifying their risk. It is crucial to understand these distinctions. I understand that this is an uncomfortable topic, and for many, this episode might be triggering. But I can't stress the importance of understanding, not just clinically, but humanly. Self-harm is typically about finding relief from emotional overwhelm or sensory distress. It's especially pronounced in neurodivergent individuals, like those with autism spectrum disorder, ADHD, borderline personality disorders. Researchers like Marsha Linen have shown that for people with BPD, self-harm is paradoxically a method to manage severe emotional pain, not an intent to die. Similarly, individuals with ADHD might self-injure impulsively during moments of intense emotional turmoil, whilst autistic individuals often self-harm to cope with overwhelming sensory input or to communicate distress when words are failing. In contrast, suicide is often marked by severe depression, despair, or a sense of inescapable pain. As noted by the Merck manuals, while self-harm might signal distress and a need for relief, suicidal intent is about complete cessation, an ending of life to stop unbearable emotional agony. Recognizing these differences can help save lives. If you see someone self-harming, know that it's rarely a death wish. It's often a deeply personal battle for survival and emotional regulation. If someone expresses suicidal thoughts, understand that they are caught in a desperate spiral of pain and hopelessness, genuinely believing there is no other way out. Every scar has a story. As medics, it's our duty to listen, validate, and offer compassionate support. The lines can blur, but understanding the intent can guide us toward helping someone choose life. Remember that your journey towards love and acceptance is a testament to your resilience and strength. Your neurodiversity isn't something to overcome. It is an integral part of your identity. It is worthy of celebration. And embracing your true self is your path towards meaningful and healthy connections. It is also important to understand that the nuances of self-harm and suicide within the context of neurodiversity. According to the Mental Health First Aid course, self-harm is commonly used as a coping mechanism to manage emotional states, distress, or sensory overload, particularly within the neurodivergent communities. This first aid course emphasizes the need for compassionate intervention and understanding the underlying reasons for self-injury, often rooted in efforts to regain control or communicate distress. Conversely, suicidal ideation and behavior, as the course highlights, usually stem from profound feelings of hopelessness or a desire to escape a pain that feels inescapable. Recognizing the signs early and responding with empathy can make all of the difference. Organizations like Mental Health First Aid and the National Autistic Society offer crucial resources and training to both support self-harm and suicidal ideation, especially within neurodivergent populations. I do wish I had some profound conclusion or some simple way to wrap this up with a message of healing and hope. But the truth is, I still struggle with these thoughts, not in the same way and not in the same intensity, but they linger. The echoes of what I once believed still sit in the back of my mind, whispering when things get hard. The trick is that sometimes I just have to remind myself that my thoughts are not always the truth, and the way I felt in those moments was real, but that doesn't mean it was right. Just because my mind told me I was a burden doesn't mean I was. Most of all, the people who loved me but still love me are not better off without me. It's still hard to explain. It always will be. It is still an uncomfortable conversation. But if sharing this experience helps even one person feel less alone in their battle, then maybe that's the reason I'm still here.
I hope you find some peace of mind in this lifetime.